Tonight we'll continue on looking at the first foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of body. This is the third in this series of eight talks on the Satipatthana Sutta. And before I do this, I want to note something that I think is quite striking. There's four foundations, but I wouldn't say the bulk, but a big chunk of the teaching is on mindfulness of body. There's so much emphasis. About half the sutta is about mindfulness of body, almost half. And at first I was surprised by that. And then as I thought about it, it's like, no, if we can learn to really tune in, if we're trying to be in the present moment, the body is the easiest thing to tune into because it's so there. Though there are subtle things going on in the body all the time, there's also lots of very obvious sensations that we experience in the body. And so mindfulness of body is a great sort of gateway into the practice and learning how to pay attention and note what's actually arising. And also, as you get deeper into these teachings and we start looking at some of the issues of mental problems that arise as we practice, being able to tune into the body is often a very skillful way to work with the larger issues at the emotional, mental level that arise as we go deeper into the practice. Having the body there to sort of anchor us in our practice is very important. And so that's why there's so much emphasis on the body and why we do it first. That's where it begins. You'd think meditation would start with the mind, right? But actually, next week we start a little bit about the mind. But we're really, the body is sort of the key to the whole thing in some ways. So I'm only going to read some more from the sutta. There's three different sections on mindfulness of body I still want to read and talk about with you. So this is called the body parts, right? Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu reviews this same body up from the soles of the feet and down from the top of the hair, bound by skin, as full of many kinds of impurity. Thus, in this body there are head hair, body hair, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, contents of the stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. Just as though there were a bag with an opening at both ends of many sorts of grain, such as hill rice, red rice, beans, peas, millets, and white rice, and a man with good eyes were to open it and review it thus. This is hill rice, this is red rice. So, I mean, when you first read this, it's like, ew. what's he doing here? Why this? And what he's trying to make us understand is that often when we think of our body, and even more importantly, when we think of other people's bodies, we get stuck on the surface. And the surface becomes what's the big deal. And he's saying, well, no, if you start looking inside what's going on inside the body, it ain't pretty at all. I've done some anatomy lab work where you've gone, with corpses. And you start to see how so much of the body is this sort of like stuff that's in there that has, like it doesn't, that glossy outer surface we pay much so much attention to, is like not that big a deal really when you start looking at the whole body. So part of what he's trying to do here is make us notice our obsession with the surface and not look deeper. And part of it is traditionally said to sort of to create a sense of of the body. The disgust, but not in the sense of like who needs a body, because without a body we couldn't do the practice. But not disgust in the sense of being caught up in making it beautiful all the time. You know, and dressing it up and doing the makeup thing and the scent thing and all those things that we do culturally or whatever, how unimportant they are. Just so that's one aspect to this. And there's another whole aspect to this. Remember, this is a meditation instruction. This is an actual instruction on how you could possibly meditate. And some of you may have heard of S.N. Goenka, who was one of the people who originally brought mindfulness teaching out to the world more. He was an Indian gentleman and the Indian government hired him originally to teach mindfulness in prisons in India to help deal with the fact that all the people were really restless. And this idea of doing a body scan was the form of the practice. This was the verse, in a sense, in the Satipatthana Sutta that he keyed into. And his whole method of meditation isn't noting as I've been teaching at all. What he says is, just do this, follow the instructions, go through each section of the body, paying attention to the internal as well as the external. And when you get to the end of that, just start all over again. It's just a different way to concentrate the mind. Within the Goenka tradition, that's the main form of the practice. And I want to point this out for two reasons. One is, some of you might have encountered Goenka and will wonder why I don't talk about this very much. But to be honest with you, I've tried this. For me, it's like, eh. Didn't really work for me. It just doesn't grab me somehow or other. That's just me. Maybe for you it would be different. And the other thing is, I want to make sure you understand that how I'm teaching mindfulness, this idea of noting what's arising and, you know, choosing what sticks out the most is the thing you note. It's just one way. Using the breath as an anchor is just one way. There are traditions and teachers in Thailand and Burma, for instance, who take another bit of the instructions. You know, where there's I read last week about when you're extending an arm, know you're extending your arm. And when you're flexing your arm, know you're flexing your arm. Well, in their school, everybody goes around going all day long, just flexing and extending. So instead of watching the breath, they're rhythmically watching the sensations of extension and the sensations of flexion. It's just a different way to do it. So it's not like this is what I'm talking is the only way. It's just the way I've learned it and the way that works for me. All I can really teach is what I know because I practice this way and it works for me. But I want you to be aware that you may come across lots of other ways of people talking about and teaching mindfulness other than the idea of noting that I mean harping away at. Okay, so that's one. Now, if you think that's strange, next we come to these are called the 9 charnel ground contemplations. And this is an actual tradition in Southeast Asia. Often people, you know, people, we think of people in Asia being cremated, right? A lot of people can't afford to get someone cremated. Literally, it's like they get all that wood and then it's like it's a big expense. And so there are in most, especially in the rural areas, there's an area outside a town where you take bodies and you just leave them there, the charnel ground. And just literally, and the Buddha would really tell people, it's to his monks and nuns, go and sit in the charnel ground to meditate. If you want to learn about things, here's what you're going to do. And this was the instructions he gave people about this particular form of practice. Not that I understand, I've never done this, but it's another way to think about things. And I'll tell you why I think it's so important. But I want to read the actual instructions first. Again, Again, bhikkhus, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, 1 or 2 or 3 days dead, bloated, livid, and oozing matter. A bhikkhu compares this same body with it thus. This body too is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. Again, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, being devoured by crows, hawks, vultures, dogs, jackals, and various kinds of worms. Again, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, a skeleton with flesh and blood held together with sinews, a skeleton smeared with blood held together with sinews, a skeleton without flesh and blood held together with sinews, disconnected bones scattered in all directions. Here a hand bone, there a foot bone, here a shin bone, there a thigh bone, here a hip bone, there a backbone, here a rib bone, there a breast bone, here an arm bone. A bhikkhu compares this same body with us. This body too is of the same nature. It will be that it is not exempt from that fate. Again, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in the charnel ground, bones bleached white, the color of shells, bones heaped up, bones more than a year old, rotted and crumbled to dust. A bhikkhu compares this same body with it thus. So this sounds pretty like macabre almost, right? But what he's pointing to here is often in our mind, we don't accept the idea of impermanence for this body. Oh, those other bodies, yeah. That's what's going to happen to everybody else, but not me. And he's forcing us to understand this body is impermanent. This body, all those other bodies, everybody you love, everybody you don't love, doesn't make any difference. They're all impermanent. They're all can go just like that. And then they decay, especially if you know, in the charnel ground image, you can see all the steps. He's like very, very precise with all the steps that a body goes through, and is gradually decays until it's like after a year, so it's just a pile of dust. You can't even tell it's a body; it's just a bunch of dust. And it's like this is a way to really start to understand impermanence, one of the three prime factors that we have to start to understand so that we can not get caught up in holding on to things and pushing things away all the time, not get caught in grasping, clinging. It's because we start to see that no matter what we hold on to, for whatever reason, usually because we really like it, sometimes because we really don't like it and we get stuck holding on to it anyway, it's going to go. Everything's impermanent. And this is a way to really understand impermanence. Now, there's no charnel grounds around Boulder that I know of. It's not, you know, we've very much in our culture sanitized this sort of thing. You know, so there's a lot of people who've never even seen a body. And certainly very few children. It's like not back in, you know, this is 2,500 years ago, this would mean such like a common thing. People would walk by, oh, there's their child. There's old Charlie. What's left of him? He was there for, you know, so we put him there 6 months ago and everybody would know about it and it'd be like a normal thing. And now we sort of don't do that. It's not polite, right? Even to talk about it is kind of risque almost. But, I think there's one really wonderful way you can, in a sense, in our culture today, get a similar sort of experience. And that is to do hospice work. And I'm actually speaking from having spent 10 years of my life doing hospice work a couple of different times. It's such a powerful way to really tune into this idea of impermanence. And at the same time, be of real use in the world. I think being a hospice volunteer is one of the wonderful things people can do in this world in terms of being useful. And I think that's very much a part of this practice. So, but it's like, it's a way you can sort of combine being very useful and actually tune in to this energy that the Buddha is talking about. This fact that, I can't tell you the number of people I've been with who've been close to death or who I've been with as they died. And it's like, it happens to everyone. No exception. It's always different. Everybody's got their own way of doing it. But, and then even like, I spent a lot of time, like 6 months talking to people as they slowly go through the process and watching that change go over the 6 month period. And you really learn to see how absolutely impermanent these bodies are. This stuff we take so much time and worry so much about. And just like that, it'll be gone. It's amazing to me. So those are the other two ideas. And I'm not suggesting that you should, though you might want to try the body scan as a way. I also know people, by the way, who will do, and when they first sit, will do the whole body scan once, just as a way of settling and like tuning in, because they understand mindfulness of the body is so important. If they tune into the body in that way, it helps them sort of tune into where, oh, look, there's a lot of sensation there today, sort of get a way of feeling into the body before you sit. And a way of, it gives you a couple of minutes to sort of settle. And I have friends who do this sort of thing a lot as a way to start their practice. Everybody does it. I actually have a few little prayers I say before I sit, usually. It's the same idea. It's a way for me to settle my mind. So you can all find your own way of doing it. Okay, so that's the instructions, except there's one other part that I haven't really spent any time with at all. And that's within this whole section on mindfulness of body. The Buddha actually also does something very interesting. He has what's called the refrain. So after each of these sections I've been talking about over the last 3 weeks, this refrain then comes into the sutta. And it's the same refrain every time. It's sort of like, you sing a song and there's the main, there's the verses and then there's the refrain. Well, this is the same sort of thing. And at first, when I first studied this stuff a long time ago, it was like, why does he keep repeating this? what's the big deal here? But as I looked closer at it, I saw that within the refrain itself is some very key teachings on mindfulness of body and on mindfulness even in a broader sense as well, because the refrain continues to the other foundations as well. I want to read the refrain to you and then talk about a few of the what I think are the key things in this teaching. So in this way, he abides contemplating the body as a body internally. He abides contemplating the body as a body externally, or he abides contemplating the body both internally or externally. He abides contemplating the body, its nature of arising, or he abides contemplating in the body, its nature of vanishing, or he abides contemplating in the body, its nature of both arising and vanishing. Or else, mindfulness that there is a body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. There's a lot going on there. But let's just go through it. I want to go through a couple of pieces very briefly, and then I'll spend some more time on the latter parts. Firstly, just about abiding the body, abides contemplating the body both internally and externally. I talked about this a few weeks ago in another talk I gave. But basically what he's saying is we have this thing of like, well, there's my body and those other people's bodies. And we sort of have this idea that they're somehow separate. And we also have this very strong tendency, even with our own body, to think that, you know, this is my hand and that thing down there is my leg. Right? We have these concepts about our body. But if we're actually being mindful, and I want to try a little experiment here. I want you just to place one of your hands on your thigh. Just place it there, close your eyes, and just tune into the sensation of your hand on your thigh. And just really see what's actually happening, what's actually there. And then, as you're doing that, see if you can tell, just by paying attention to the raw sensation itself, where hand ends and thigh begins. And the truth is, we can't. We can't be that precise. But we'll say, my hand is on my thigh, because we have this concept of hand and this concept of thigh. And so, of course, there's my hand on my thigh. But really, all that's going on there is sensation. There's this sensation of pressure or heat or whatever is going on there, whatever, however you noted it. But that's all that's ever really happening. And so what he's talking about here, when we note it internally, is like that, it's just, oh, there's this sensation. It isn't like, you know, my hand is on my leg. That's not the noting we're doing. We're just noting sensation, heat, cold, itchy, whatever. And then when he mentions that, you can also note what's going on externally. Well, often people think that, you know, other people making noises, other people being around, other people breathing heavily, who knows what they're doing, are somehow a disturbance when we're practicing. And the truth is, now you just note that. So, but that's noting externally, outside your body, into that, noting that other body making that noise, but it's just something to note. It isn't any more valid or invalid than what's going on in your body. So that's the internally, externally. Then he says, contemplating the arising and the vanishing. Now he's pointing again to impermanence. Things arise, they're there for a while, and then they're gone. It's like we might be, when we're noting, we know we're sort of tuned into some sort of strong sensation. You know, where our hand is on our leg somehow just becomes fascinating. And we're noting that, and we're noting that, and noting that. And then our mind goes someplace else. It just goes. Something else has popped up that's more prominent, and that's what we're noting. And it's like our hand isn't on our leg anymore, almost. It's like we're just, the mind has shifted its ray of focus to some other thing, and those other things just vanish from our attention. It's not like our hand isn't actually physically on our thigh anymore. It's just that we're not paying attention to it at all. Things arise, they're there for a while, and then they vanish. Yeah. But then he says, I think, and this is the thing that really fascinates me, or else mindfulness that there is a body is simply established. What is it? There is a body. This is a really interesting phrase. It's like he's saying, instead of getting sort of lost in the focus on every particular little detail, which is sometimes the case when we're noting, as I've been explaining, it's sometimes you can actually sort of step back and just note, there is the body. The combination of all those sense things that are happening all at the same time, really, if we put it all together, then what there is to note is there is a body. So it's like, instead of taking the micro view of things, there's that itch, there's my, that itch, there's that, there's this, there's that sound. There's just like, there is a body that is sensing. And what he's also pointing out here is that if we're not careful, we can take these teachings to somehow start thinking that this body isn't real. You know, and you see people say exactly that as a, and get into a lot of problems because of that, because now they don't take care of the body. Well, it's just not real anyway, so I don't, you know. This body is very real, even though it's impermanent. It never stops changing, even for a moment. Absolutely, that's true. But, and this is a phrase from one of my teachers. But in it is this ever-changing stream of physical and mental phenomena, conventionally known as Barry, that is what I think of as self. As long as I don't think of it as permanent and unchanging, this particular view of self isn't a problem. We have bodies. This is a body. So as long as I don't attach to it, as long as I am aware that it's just an ever-changing stream of physical and mental phenomena, then we don't get caught by it. And the truth is, to function in the world, we better be aware that we have a body, right? Otherwise, we put our hand on the hot burner, or, you know, stab ourselves with a knife when we're trying to cut up a cucumber. I mean, you know, we have to be aware of where the edges of our body are and those sorts of things. We have to have that awareness. But if at the same time we have this awareness that this is just a stream of changing, ever-changing physical and mental phenomena that conventionally people call Barry out of convenience, or they call it Lisa or Ted or Sharon or whoever they call it, right? It's just, that's the label that got attached to that. Also note that this, and I think this is quite important, that the phrase that he's suggesting is, there is a body. It isn't, I have a body, or this is my body. It's simply, all those sensations put together indicate there is a body. That's all. There's no personness attached to it. It's just, there is a body. The language in and of itself points to the idea that it's just this ball of sensation indicates that. It's not separate. It's not special. It's just, there is a body. Because that's what we're paying attention to as we practice. Okay. Then the next part of this sentence, I'll go back to this sentence. So, or else mindfulness that there is a body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. The extent necessary. It's really an interesting phrase again, because now he's saying we have to put some effort into this. We have to actually pay attention. We have to be aware that there is a body. But we don't want to sort of get so wrapped up in it. So just to the extent necessary that we're aware there is a body. That's what we want to do. It's like the middle path. You know, people are always talking about the Buddha's teaching, the middle path. We don't want to. So if we strive, if we push too hard, if we want, I'm going to note every sensation that happens in my body, and it's going to be so, I'm going to be such a good meditator. And you know, we turn into a striver, and it's like really unpleasant pretty quickly because there's no way you can do that anyway. So But at the same time, if you're not careful, you can sort of become this sort of laid back, just letting things go by. Oh, yeah, there's another sensation. Ho hum. You know, we don't put enough effort into it. And so we're trying to find this balance that, so to the extent necessary, knows the right amount of energy is being applied to actually be aware of what's actually arising in the body at any moment, that we can then note. So it's this just enough between too hard and too soft. Somewhere in the middle, to the extent necessary. And remember, this is something he repeats over and over and over again. This whole set of instructions is repeated, I think, like 19 times in the sutta. These instructions are repeated. So yeah, that's the other thing. If he repeats it this many times, maybe he should pay some attention to it. You know, there must be something important here. I should, you know, probably tune into these things. And then at the end of this, he says, and he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. Yeah. He abides independent, not clinging to anything. This is, in a sense, one way to define enlightenment. This is a definition of someone who's enlightened. He abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. So he's pointing out that all of these instructions, again and again, he's pointing out that all of these instructions are instructions that lead to enlightenment. That that's what this practice is all about. Like, that's why we're putting so much energy into this, so much effort into this practice, is that that's where we want to go, in that direction. And remembering, and this is very important, that it's the process. It's the road, not the destination. That's important. We're having little moments of enlightenment all the time. All we're doing is practicing in ways that hopefully make those moments last longer and occur more frequently. And over time, they become normal. That's how we interact with the world. So that's sort of the end of what I have to say about mindfulness of body. So this last bit I was talking about, it's an interesting experiment sometimes. If you find yourself noting, and it's like you're noting things that arise in the body, and it becomes sort of like, oh God, now there's my knee up. You know, to start, do this idea of stepping back and just tuning into the body as a whole is an interesting place to sort of play a little bit and see what happens if you do that. It's like a wide angle lens as opposed to a zoom lens. Not that one's better than the other. It's just that sometimes it'll make more sense. It'll help you stay focused, stepping back as opposed to zooming in. And this is just something we learn through practice. I can't tell you, oh, this is when you should do this. It's just we practice and we figure this out as we go along. Okay. So now, having gone through this instruction period, let's actually practice. So, as I've said before to the people listening to the recording of this talk, if you're at this point, you should pause the recording and then pick it up after you've done your half hour of sitting practice, or however long your sitting practice is. We're going to sit for half an hour here now. So find that comfortable upright position. Feet grounded. Maybe just scan through the body, even if it's just like, a simple, there's my feet, yeah, there's my legs, yep, they're still there. There's my abdomen, I can sort of feel those squishy things in there. I can feel my heart beating, I feel my arms hanging down, my neck, my head. Something really simple, or as he describes it in the sutta, much more detailed, going through really piece by piece, tuning into everything. Helps you settle into the present moment. Helps you settle into awareness of there is a body. It has all those component parts. Put them all together, all the fascinating different sensations. Or just note what's strongest, what's arising that grabs your attention the most. Remember, the noting can either just be, it's just a simple word, maybe two words. And it could just be the sense door, or it could be some descriptive word, like you smell something and it might be strong or weak or sweet, whatever. Words, you know, the same with taste and body sensations, they all have lots of words we use to describe these sort of sensations. If one of those words sort of naturally pops up into your mind as what's going on, use that word as a note. It helps you stay a little closer to the experience. Or if it's a bit vaguer, just note the sense door itself. Feeling, smelling, tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, thinking. And remembering that if everything is just sort of neutral, there's nothing that grabs you, nothing that's catching your attention, it's always okay to just go back to the breath, which is conveniently always there. It's sort of, it's described as the anchor, and an anchor stops you from floating away, right? If we're not careful, all those neutral thoughts, pretty soon our mind just drifts. But if we go back to the anchor, then we don't float away. We have always have something to note, because the breath is always there. So I'm going to turn off my mic now, and we'll sit for about 30 minutes. So this poem is once again from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In, that many of you have asked me about before. This is a poem called Walk Slowly. It only takes a reminder to breathe, a moment to be still. And just like that, something in me settles, softens, makes space for imperfection. The harsh voice of judgment drops to a whisper. And I remember again that life isn't a relay race, that we will all cross the finish line, that waking up to life is what we were born for. As many times as I forget, catch myself charging forward without even knowing where I'm going, that many times I can make the choice to stop, to breathe and be, and walk slowly into the mystery. I love that last line, walking slowly into the mystery, because it's really all we can do, because life's a mystery. I mean, what comes next is a total mystery. So we may as well walk slowly into it and enjoy it. It's just I like the attitude of that poem, because it has that sort of sense to it. Let's dedicate the merit now. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. As usual, thank you all for joining me. So next week we move on from the body into the mind. Oh my God. not that the body won't still be there, but we're actually going to start looking at instructions on, next week we're going to look at the second foundation of mindfulness, which is the shortest and simplest of all the foundations, but actually really key to this whole practice to understand what it's talking about. One particular form of mental arising called Vedana, which roughly translates as feeling tone. And I'll spend quite a bit of time talking about that next week, so I won't say anything more now. So for now, I hope you're all enjoying your late fall weather. It's November weather we're having. I have to spend a lot of time cleaning up my garden tomorrow. I went to McGuckin's and got a double batch of leaf bags. I'm ready to just get to work and put the garden to sleep much earlier than I wanted it to. So, but that's didn't expect that either. Just walk slowly into the mystery, right? See you all again soon.
Night.
Good night.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. See you, Deborah.